Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program here on WILL. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. More than 150 people were killed earlier this month in a burst of ethnic violence in western China. The rioting there involved members of the Uyghur minority and Han Chinese, who make up the bulk of China's population. The Han have moved in increasing numbers into this northwestern region of China, Xinjiang. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Linda Benson. She's professor of history at Oakland University. That's in Rochester, Michigan. We'll try to get a better understanding of this violence in Xinjiang and also consider how the Chinese government treats some of its other ethnic minorities, and there are more than 50 of them officially recognized. Questions, of course, are welcome, too, here on the program. The only thing we ask is that people do keep their comments and questions relevant to the topic and be as brief as you can just so we can make room for other callers. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. And the call will be on us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions and comments from listeners are certainly welcome. Professor Benson, hello.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
Well, we really appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think probably a good way to start would be for me to ask you just to talk a little bit about Xinjiang. What's this part of China like?
Well, the Xinjiang region is huge. It's about one-sixth of China's territory, so that is indeed a very, very large area that we're talking about. It is part of what is sometimes called the Western Regions of China. So to the south of Xinjiang is Tibet, and nearby is a huge province called Qinghai. These are areas that traditionally have not been home to very many Han Chinese, although they've had a long relationship with China, of course, several thousand years, in fact. But the region itself is, in general, considered to be rather remote from the rest of China. It's outside the core of Chinese civilization, that is the central part of China where most Han Chinese live. So in that sense, it's been a kind of borderland, and that's really the key here. It's been a borderland for many, many centuries, and in many ways, it's culturally far closer to the rest of Central Asia than it is to Chinese civilization. Mm-hmm. So it's a unique territory. I think really also very beautiful in its own way, desert landscapes, but those are mixed with some marvelous mountains, some of the highest in the world, and these are wonderful, wonderful part of the scenery in what is really a very beautiful, if rather isolated, region within China.
The Uyghur people make up a bare majority of the population here. As you've said, that the Han have moved in increasing numbers so that we get to the point where if we go back, say, 1949, this is, the benchmark figure that I've seen, about 6% of the population of Xinjiang was Han, and now it's over 40%. And I guess in cities, the concentrations of Han, particularly in the capital, Urumqi, are very high. But barely now, the Uyghur people still make up a majority of the population of Xinjiang.
Yes, they do. And the distribution of the population is important. You know, Urumqi really was founded more or less as a Chinese strong point, a strong place from which to launch their conquest of other parts of that region. So it's mostly been a Chinese city for much of its history. And it has about 75% Han Chinese. There are other places, though, where Uyghurs are a majority, even today, and that's mostly in the south of the region, and specifically in Kashgar, which is one of the largest cities that is, I think, upwards of 80% Uyghur, even today. So it kind of depends what area we're looking at. But yes, you're right that the percentage overall of Han present in the area has definitely increased, and that is one of the sources of tension.
Mm. And the increase in Han, this has been something that has been the result of a deliberate policy by the Chinese government?
Well, initially it was. It's an area that Chinese really have not been willing to go to. This was attempted, actually, even in the 19th century. The government wanted to send more Chinese there, but it was viewed as so far away and really very alien. So after the communist government took over in 1949, they did have a policy where they tried to encourage Han to go to that region. And since they were the ones who could really assign you your job or your position, they were able to send a lot of Chinese there. But the numbers really didn't start to swell until the railroad link was finished at the end of the 50s. And then in the 60s is when we have a much larger number arriving, boosted, of course, by military as well. So it's only that policy that really sent out a lot of people. More recently, people have gone willingly. Xinjiang's economy has done fairly well. So there have been jobs there that have drawn Chinese from other areas. And we're seeing some of those people, I think, are, as the ones caught up in the most recent violence. These are people who don't necessarily know the region well. They don't know its history. They don't really understand who the Uyghur people are or how long they have been there. And I think that kind of ignorance is partly what we're seeing emerging in some of the violence in past weeks.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the fact that the people here, the indigenous people of Xinjiang, have much more in common culturally with West Asia and peoples to the West than they do with people to the East. What would be some of the significant cultural differences between the Uyghur and the Han?
Well, first of all, one of the major differences, of course, is going to be in language and religion. The people in Xinjiang, the Uyghur people, I mean, they are Sunni Muslim, so that, of course, sets them apart. They speak a language that is related to Turkic languages, and Turkic languages have been spoken in that part of the world for many, many centuries, probably at least two millennia. And so they are set apart by very important markers, both by their religion and also by their language. Turkic languages are spoken from Xinjiang all the way across to Turkey. So Central Asian languages, Uzbek, Kazakhs, and so on, all of these are Turkic languages. And so they share that with these neighbors just to the west of them. So those are one of the elements that set them apart. But there are also racial differences. Some Uyghurs, friends, colleagues of mine, look very European indeed. There are others who look perhaps Eurasian, but there is a racial element that's also there. So it's a more obvious division, I would say, than there is with other kinds of minority groups or minorities that live in other parts of China.
Just to very quickly introduce again our guest, we're talking this morning with Linda Benson. She's professor of history at Oakland University. That's in Rochester, Michigan. And in her work, she's particularly interested in modern China and Inner Asia. And we're talking about China's ethnic minorities, and particularly we want to talk about what happened in Western China, Northwestern China, in this region of Xinjiang, where there was violence, ethnic violence, between the indigenous people, the Uyghurs, and the Han. The people who had been moving in from east for some time now, and talk a little bit about what happened there specifically, but also maybe talk in a larger sense about the issue of minorities in China. Yes, go ahead.
The religious element is certainly an important part of it, but we have to be very careful there. There are other Muslims in China, other Muslim populations. Some of them actually have done very well. Mm-hmm. So we have to kind of sort out the Muslim side of it. The central government has used Islam as one way to crack down on that area, trying to link it to the global war on terrorism, and many, of course, of those are Muslim terrorists, it's implied. So they have tried to link those two together, but in fact it's not fully religious. The other largest group of Muslims are the Hui people. In number, they're maybe around 10 to 11 million. The Hui are scattered all over China. There are mosques really all over China as well. And many of these people have done fairly well under the current government. One of the differences, of course, is that Hui are fundamentally Chinese. They share a lot of Chinese culture. They speak Chinese. They always have. So they are part of the very earliest influx of Muslims into China and established themselves everywhere, but really with far fewer problems than we've seen in the Northwest. So in the Northwest, it's really a mixture of a number of elements, perhaps partly racial, certainly ethnic, but also it's an issue because of the increasing tension caused at least in part by the presence of so many Han Chinese. And as I said, Chinese who are really not aware of some of the differences in this region and the rest of China.
Well, I want to talk about, have you talk more specifically about what happened there in Urumqi in earlier July. But what I thought was very interesting, and I'm not sure how widely this gets reported, it seems to be that what happened there in July was really touched off by, or perhaps inspired by, or related to something that happened earlier back in June, a long way away in another part of China where there was violence involving Uyghurs and Han.
Yeah, that is certainly what we are hearing from different groups. And, of course, there are a number of groups now, including the Chinese government, that have already put their own political spin on some of the events that started on July 5th. That count actually has been going up. The last I heard in terms of those killed was over 180. A number of people also in hospital. They were very concerned that those people might die. The incident in South China presumably involved two Uyghurs who were there looking for work, looking for better opportunities. We have a lot of that going on in China these days, and that does include people from minority areas going into what are essentially Han Chinese areas like South China. And there were two men. They were accused, I believe the accusation was of rape. A crowd gathered. These two men are obviously outsiders in such a local area, and they were killed by the crowd. And so one view is that this was a peaceful demonstration. It began as a protest over the slowness with which the Chinese authorities were beginning their investigation of this. And people in Urumqi felt that their two fellow minority members, their fellow Uyghurs, were not being treated well and that they wanted some kind of action on this. And that prompted them to take to the streets. As far as I have heard from people, that does seem to be the basis of the original demonstration. And then, of course, as we know, it horribly spiraled way out of control and led to not only attacks on the Uyghurs who were demonstrating, but also by ordinary Han Chinese in the region who returned what they perceived as an attack on themselves and on their government and their military.
I'd like to look at what both the Uyghurs and the Chinese government say about the relationship between the two groups and how the Uyghurs have fared. The Uyghurs, for their part, say that they have faced discrimination. There have been deliberate attempts by the government to restrict the practice of their religion, of Islam. They haven't banned it outright, but they have done a number of things that certainly make it look like the Chinese are trying to, let's say, undercut or erode the cultural foundations for the religion. And overall, I think their complaint is that what the Chinese are trying to do is dilute their culture to the point where they're not going to be what they were before. Is that a justified complaint?
Well, there are a lot of elements of truth in that. Of course, you have people coming from outside. They're not terribly sensitive, perhaps, to local concerns. They really don't know about Islam. They don't know about the history of the region. And they are there really to make money. I think a lot of ordinary Chinese also see this as a region where it's theirs really by right. Historically, they've always had this territory, and it's theirs to really keep and to hold on to. So with that attitude, of course, coming up against the Uyghurs, who already had concerns about Chinese presence all through the 20th century, then it's really a very, very tense circumstance. The Uyghur complaints, I think, are justified in many ways, especially since 9/11. There have been limitations on worship. For a time there, it was possible for Uyghur Muslims to make Hajj, to go to Mecca. Now that's very, very difficult. It's hard to get papers. There are many requirements placed on those people who would like to travel to do that, something that is essential for a Muslim. There are restrictions on religious education. There are imams who are being forced to really follow the party line, and local people very deeply resent that. There are resentments also over family planning. Now, it's true that minorities can have more than one child. Most Uyghurs are allowed to have two children. There are other minorities in Xinjiang, like the Kazakhs. If they live in a remote area, they can have as many as three children. But nonetheless, even these, which in the Chinese view are generous, of course, exceptions, even these are not viewed that way. They're viewed rather as an interference in cultural matters, and that, religious issues, and also issues related to language are also a matter of complaint. And here I think they are justified. Increasingly, Uyghur language is being sidetracked. If you want to do well in today's Xinjiang and you want to make money, you really do need to have mastery of Chinese. And the government there, of course, has Uyghur language schools so that your children can go to Uyghur language schools. They do study Chinese language, but they're instructed in Uyghur. And you can go all the way through high school. But if you want to go to college, you really do have to be able to function in Chinese. And increasingly, that is being viewed as a burden. So there are many areas here that are cultural. They are things that are cause for concern if you really are trying to maintain your cultural integrity. And those things, I think, come out whenever there is an incident like this that's triggered by an incident even as far away as Guangdong.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of the writing that I've seen about this, it seems that as far as what the Chinese government says and ethnic Han Chinese people say about the Uyghurs, the word that continues to come up again and again in stories is ungrateful. That is, yes, is somehow that the government says, now look at all of the things that we have been doing for these people. We offer them economic opportunity. There is this exemption from the one-child policy. And they'd say we have tried to set up what in effect are affirmative action goals for Uyghur people in education and employment. And all in all, we're trying to do the right thing by these people. And are they grateful? No. And that's the Chinese line, and I would expect that probably a lot of people around China would say yes, that's right. They are ungrateful, and they should be more thankful for what we're doing. What would you say about that kind of argument?
Well, I think for many Chinese, I lived for a long time in Hong Kong and also in Taiwan, and whenever I would mention that I was studying the far northwest, people would often be very curious. They would say it's a backward area, it's not really Chinese culture, why don't you look at, you know, Shanghai or some of the areas that are doing so well these days. And of course, I was interested in it because it was a very different part of China, and yet I was interested in the policy, really. And it was very different, and yet it is certainly within the Chinese sphere today and has always been of concern to the Chinese government. So I think in those communities, both Hong Kong and Taiwan, it's generally assumed these are our areas, and it's really kind of our duty to look after these people. And in the language in China, it's often portrayed as a situation of the older brother looking after the younger brother, that we need to help these people to develop. We want their economy to grow. We want them to be better educated, looked after better in terms of health care, and so on. But that kind of paternalism, which is kind of a hallmark of other parts of the world where you have a majority really taking over an area that is of a different cultural heritage, we find similar instances. This is a kind of colonial ingratitude, I think is a term that's been coined, where people really do want some of these aspects of a modern life, but they want to do it themselves. They don't want to have this brought from outside. They don't want to have people from outside making all the decisions, particularly over aspects of their economy. And in Xinjiang, of course, that includes a very wealthy oil and natural gas resources that are being developed largely through government money. Now, I'm sure the government view is that this will benefit Xinjiang and all its people, but the local population see a lot of that wealth being exported to coastal China to fuel the economic growth there. So there's always going to be two sides, and it depends, of course, on the state of relations between the people who are supposedly being helped and the people who are intent on helping them, maybe whether they want that help or not.
It certainly seems that there's a story that we hear in this case, and I wonder to what extent you hear it other places in China, where people complain. They'd say, look, we have a culture here, and we want to preserve that culture. And to us, that means more than just dressing up in our national costumes on one national holiday and posing for pictures with tourists. But it seems that the Chinese government thinks as long as you can still do that, that somehow means that continues to be a living culture. Is that, do you see that played out other places?
Well, you know, there are places in South China, for example, that have benefited tremendously from tourist dollars. And, you know, minorities are marketed. You can go online and look up different minority regions in China, and the tours that are being offered to some of these very interesting parts of China, some of those tours really do. They show the uniqueness of the local people, and that usually means wearing local clothes, fixing versions of local dishes, local music and dance, and so on. And, of course, this is like other places that are inundated with tourism. On the one hand, local people do see a financial benefit. We see this in Southeast Asia as well. There's a financial benefit from having tourists come and spend their money. But on the other hand, is this really a process whereby you're becoming like a kind of Disneyland, a kind of show where people can come in, spend a few hours, not really be educated in the culture, and then leave? Also, who is controlling that tourist industry? Is this going to be something that's shared with the local people or not? Are they just going to benefit by doing a few dances, or will they have a larger say in how their culture is portrayed and in what aspects of it are going to be marketed? So it's a difficult issue. I suppose there are always going to be some folks on the side, local folks on the side of saying, you know, really, this is a way for us to improve our status and therefore is positive. But again, I think it does depend on the state of relations between that local population and those who are in charge of the economic development, which usually is the Han Chinese group that is dominating the Communist Party and also local government.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, all of the reporting about what happened earlier in the month used the language ethnic violence to talk about it. And I did it myself in talking about this program. And certainly we have conflict here between two groups that are two distinct groups. At the same time, you wonder whether this is primarily about ethnicity or is this really about economic opportunity?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to divide those two, particularly in Xinjiang. You don't really see incidents like this in other areas, so that's another factor here. But for Xinjiang, I think any time there is an incident, a lot of these things are simply elements in what becomes a larger issue, an overwhelming issue for a lot of the Uyghurs, for example, in Xinjiang. And for them, all of these elements seem to cry out, you know, that we are about to be overwhelmed, that the Chinese who have been trying to take over this land for so long are now really taking over and that we need to do something about it. Of course, the chances of any real success in doing that are very, very slim. This area has a huge number of Han Chinese military units. It has paramilitary units. It has an incredible amount of military force arrayed in Xinjiang, some of it in the south and a lot of it on the border because of uncertainties about the future and the Central Asian republics. They have good relations with them right now, but there's always uncertainty about the future and fear about terrorism. So Xinjiang, in some ways, is a unique area. There are other parts of China where minorities have done very well. So those areas, especially those that were extremely poor and had very, very limited resources, some of those areas have done very well. So it is something unique, I think, both to Xinjiang and to Tibet, and I think part of that uniqueness is rooted in the history of those areas. They have had separate governments. They are culturally very different. They have their own history of development that they're very proud of. And in other areas where you have much less numerous minority populations, you have a different equation there and a somewhat different history as well.
We are at our midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Linda Benson. She's an historian on the faculty of Oakland University. That's in Rochester, Michigan. And she's interested in modern China, Inner Asia. We're talking about China's ethnic minorities and talking about some of what happened, the violence that happened earlier this month in the northwestern Xinjiang region of China. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. The figure, the last figure that I saw was, I think, was more than 150 people killed. And you said now, actually, it sounds like maybe it's more like 180. And a lot more people have been injured, and there are people in hospital. It seemed that the official position of the Chinese government was that most of the people who were killed were Han, and that they had been killed by Uyghurs. The Uyghurs who live outside of China say, no, that's not quite the way it is, that a lot more people were killed, and a lot of those were Uyghurs, particularly after the kind of crackdown with which the Chinese government responded. Do you have some sense of what those numbers really are? Does anybody know?
Well, David, it's a very good point. We really don't know. And part of the issue for Uyghurs, and especially Uyghurs who are living outside of China, is that they distrust most of the official government figures. The last ones I saw were 184 had been killed. Some 70 people were wounded and still in hospital and not expected to live, so that could take the number over 200. Some 1,700 were wounded, although the degree is not given. And then you're right, the official figures, the last I saw were 137 Han had been killed and 46 Uyghurs. Those numbers alone would make a lot of the overseas Uyghur community very suspicious. And I have to say that having traced incidents in this area for some time, there are often times where the numbers that are reported just seem very, very hard to believe. These may be more accurate. Just one example, in 1990, there was an incident near Kashgar, and that incident had a very low number of people who were supposedly killed in the fighting. I don't know anyone who would really accept the government numbers for that one. There was another one in 1997. Uyghurs outside of China claimed that hundreds of people were killed in 1997, and this was about the time, around the time of the death of Deng Xiaoping, the last, great leader of the People's Republic. Those numbers have never been verified. We have no idea. And even for Tiananmen, where we had so many Western reporters in the city, and there's so much video, there's film, there's photographs, even there, we really don't know the number. And of course, when the government is not interested, it seems, in giving us a number, it just fuels speculation that the numbers must be much, much higher. So I can see certainly why they are suspicious of any of the numbers or of the lists and so on. And of course, people outside of Xinjiang are very concerned about the repercussions. There have been a lot of arrests. There are people who have been taken in for interrogation. This is always something that follows any major incident of violence in Xinjiang. So a lot of people are very concerned about this. One of the things, I don't know whether you were able to see this, but there was some video just a day or two after the rioting had calmed down of women, Uyghur women, who'd taken to the streets demanding to know where their family members were. They didn't know if they were arrested or their bodies had been found, and the government simply wasn't releasing information. So it's something that has been done before by the Chinese government, very regrettable in many, many ways, but particularly because it does allow people then to guess and to estimate how many people really were involved in the fighting or the violence and how many have been killed.
Mm-hmm. The Chinese government says that ultimately the people who are responsible for this violence are militant Uyghur separatists who were interested in independence for Xinjiang. How many do you think Uyghurs truly would be would such a thing be possible, interested in independence, and how many, perhaps with the right kind of support from the Chinese government, would be just fine with staying part of China?
Well, David, I think this is the million-dollar question for Xinjiang and people who are interested in the region. It's very hard to say. On paper, if you look at the original autonomy, Xinjiang was declared an autonomous region in 1955. And if you go back and look at some of the original documents and some of the laws that have been passed, Uyghurs should have a great deal of control over what goes on in that region, and that would include parts of the economy. It would certainly include language and culture. It would even include local regulations on family planning. All of these things are actually there, but as we know, a lot of this really has been done simply by the Chinese authorities, and most Uyghurs, I think, would agree that their voice is not the predominant voice, even though some of the top officials are, as is required by law, of Uyghur nationality. But nonetheless, a lot of people there feel that this is not really what would be true autonomy. And partly what fuels that is their recent past. There was an independent secessionist state in the region, 1933, and didn't last very long, but there was another one in 1944, which is much more recent in memory, and that was called the East Turkestan Republic, and that republic did have a government. It did control the northern part of the province, so those memories are still very much around, as is some antipathy toward the Chinese. So there is some history there that suggests there is some interest, certainly, in having their own state. Now, exactly how many, now that is a very, very difficult thing to estimate. I think probably you'd have more Uyghurs saying that they would like full autonomy to be implemented, that might be something more acceptable. People with more education probably would see the need for some outside financial support. And there is a stronger Uyghur middle class today, too. And their ambitions, of course, are to have their families do well, to be educated, to become part, you know, truly part of the modern world. So for some of them, perhaps a more moderate position would be to have autonomy as it is on paper, and that would be a sufficient goal. But again, I have to say very clearly that no one really knows. It's not possible to survey everyone. These are just kind of my educated guesses on what probably would be the outcome if we were able to ask everyone what they wanted.
Mm-hmm. Given the history of tension between the Chinese government and the ethnic Han and the Uyghurs, it seems that this is a problem that's simply not going to go away. How do you think this is likely to play out?
Well, that too is a question that's hard to answer. But right now, because of the overwhelming military presence in that area, I think one of the few things Uyghurs can do is to demonstrate, to try and make the issues known, to try and make perhaps some of the Han Chinese population living there more aware of what these issues are and how they feel about it. They're doing it through the demonstrations, and I really don't know if there was permission given for that demonstration. Usually you have to have permission. Perhaps they did, perhaps they didn't. But they should find means to really publicize that. And that's a very difficult thing in China. To speak out can really get you in a lot of trouble. And younger people tend to be the least patient in looking at some of those avenues. But to return to the military, that is really a major force in that region. Not only are there regular troops, the region has areas that are dominated by what we call the Bingtuan, the Production and Construction Corps. And this is a paramilitary organization. It has huge land holdings. It runs some of the industry. It has its own independent report or annual report on its earnings and activities every year because it's so powerful. And it is very resented by many Uyghurs who are there. The Bingtuan remains mostly Han Chinese. There are some Uyghurs certainly who are in it, but it's primarily a Chinese organization with huge, huge economic clout. So as long as it is there, and as long as the government is going to maintain this idea that they need to have a presence to forestall any expansion of terrorism into the region, those things are going to make it very difficult for any group to really take positive steps. My own hope would be that Chinese scholars, those who are in positions to give advice to the government, that some of those individuals would suggest alternatives, ways to make sure that ordinary Uyghurs are going to benefit as they continue to modernize areas like Xinjiang.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Linda Benson. She is professor of history at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. And we're talking here this morning about China and about minorities in China, and very specifically about the unrest that happened a little earlier this month in the northwestern Xinjiang region of China. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to ask you about something else, and I know this is something that you've written about. It seems that in many ways, this kind of story that we have been talking about in Xinjiang parallels the story of Tibet. And certainly the Tibetan people have had similar complaints about being discriminated against and about what they see as efforts by the Chinese government to undercut their culture, their language, their practice of religion. And in the same way, the Chinese government has said, well, really what we're trying to do here is to modernize what was a backward region and bring them into the modern age and give them economic opportunity. And they talk in that same sort of paternalistic way that you talked about earlier, about the people of Tibet. And yet at the same time, the Chinese and their conduct in Tibet has gotten a lot more attention in the West. There are more people in the West who have stood up and said they think that this is wrong. And the question is, well, why is it that somehow more people haven't come to the defense of the Uyghurs in the way that they have come to the defense of the people of Tibet?
Yeah, it is interesting. And I know people in both the Tibetan independence movement and among the Uyghurs, especially the Uyghur Association here in America, who really feel that they need to have more common ground between the two, especially for those who are advocating, you know, stronger protection of these groups but are based outside of China. There has been talk about having more activities together, trying to have the two sets of issues that each group faces to be a little bit more unified. And I think part of the difficulty has been that these are very, very different entities in many ways. Linguistically, of course, they have nothing in common. Tibetan is very, very different from the Turkic languages. And, of course, religion. And those are two of the most important elements that set them apart. But you're right, of course, they both feel that they are facing the same kind of cultural oppression. You know, the Tibetan cause, I think, of course, has received most of its impetus for American support and support in Europe from the presence of the Dalai Lama. He is an amazing figure. He is a Nobel Peace Prize winner. He is known everywhere. And, of course, he is welcomed by heads of state all over the world. And, of course, his message as well is so compelling, a man of peace, someone trying to find an answer to a very, very difficult question facing all of his people in Tibet. So he himself, I think, is one of the great reasons for people seeing this as a cause that they can easily throw themselves behind. Very, very sympathetic. And the publishing in this country, the religious teachings of the Dalai Lama, which attract so much attention, these two are things that garner all kinds of support, I think, for the Tibetan cause. For the Uyghur population, of course, they do not have such a single figure as a leader. They don't have a spokesperson. But I think also they have an uphill battle, in part because they are also Muslim, you know, and that has gotten such negative press in our country. There are students of mine, you know, who kind of label the Middle East as a home for terrorists and radicals. And, of course, that's an amazingly uneducated attitude to have, but it's not so uncommon. And I think being Muslim, being in that part of the world that is of such concern and seems to be so unstable to those of us outside, I think that is something that has worked against them. There's that. The name Uyghur, of course, people don't know this name. They don't know much about the culture or the society. So it really just does not have the kind of resonance that you're going to get if you mention Tibet or the Dalai Lama or Tibetan Buddhism. And the other thing I would add to that, these two are not the largest minority groups in China by any means. They're the ones we hear about, certainly the Tibetan movement and more recently the Uyghurs, but they are not the most numerous. The single most numerous minority is a people known as the Zhuang, who have some 16, 17 million members in their minority group, so they're by far larger. But nobody really knows much at all about them. The Hui that I mentioned before, there's some 10 million, maybe as many as 11 million of them. So these are also substantial numbers, and yet a lot of those peoples are simply not known. And that's also a reflection on our knowledge about minorities in China in general, I think.
Yeah. There are, as I understand, there are 55 official minority groups. They make up only 9% of the population, but in China, that's a lot of people. That's 104 million people.
Absolutely.
Most of the population are the Han, although within that umbrella, I think there are people who are classified as Han who might well be considered a group in their own right because they have their own culture, they have their own language.
Right.
And I'm assuming that of these 55 official minority groups, probably some of them are relatively small. But as you point out, there are some that are good sized, and so you wonder, well, is there some potential, some other place in China for the kind of conflict on the scale that we've seen in Xinjiang and elsewhere involving the Uyghurs and the Han?
Yeah, well, so far it's in Tibet and in the far northwest among Uyghurs that those are the incidents that really are drawing international attention. But there is one other area which we've not been talking about very much, I think, since July 5th, and that is Inner Mongolia. There is a Mongol population, some 6.5 million, who live inside of China. And then, of course, then there is the Republic of Mongolia on the other side. And these people, too, have had a difficult time. We hear very little about that today. The Chinese are an overwhelming number in Inner Mongolia. The Mongols are only maybe 15% of the population of Inner Mongolia today. And in a sense, they're kind of a possible template for what could happen with better communication and transport for the Northwest and for Tibet. I'm not sure that the people in those regions are thinking of the Mongolian example, but because Inner Mongolia is much more accessible by road, by air, by by rail line, maybe some of them do have an idea that this is what the future might bring, and then you truly would be a minority, even in your own autonomous region. But those three are the areas of difficulty. There have been some other scattered incidents, but nothing really on the level that we're seeing for these key border populations. And I guess we should also mention some of the very less numerous minority groups, some of them have done very well. There's really not much chance of all the minorities, for example, pressuring the government or rising up against the government. That's just not going to happen. It's really those borderland peoples that have had the issues. Some of the less numerous groups have no family planning limits at all. They can have as many children as they like. These are populations that are sometimes only 100,000 or less. Most of them have all kinds of special privileges, in part because the government says it is protecting their heritage. So when it comes to those groups, which are, of course, really no threat at all, they have a very generous policy. And as you were saying before, many Chinese do feel the policy toward all the minorities is already very generous. It does include forms of affirmative action that are going to allow, say, a minority student to get into college with a lower test score. Some of these are fairly well-known parts of a policy that the Chinese see as being very positive.
All right. We have a couple of minutes left, and I have a caller here I want to bring in, so let's do that here where we are in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have been listening for a while, and I haven't had the opportunity to call in. I thought somebody should, at least. The way I see it is that this is predominantly an economic issue, as was referred to earlier, with the potentiality for being manipulated by identity. Because it, to some extent, I wonder whether you would allow this as the case, that in some parts of China, the Han identification, I mean, if people come in from the hinterlands, they're not going to look a whole lot like the people that coming into the area of to work. That's not very clear, but
okay.
but the point being that the definition isn't too careful, and I see this as part of the whole problem of, you know, having this many migrant workers. It's approaching the number of people that are in the U.S. If I'm not misled, that there's that many people that are just going where, you know, corporate and communist power is making the factories. So, but I do see that there's potentiality for manipulation, and not that I'm always blaming the U.S. first, but I wonder what how the great game fits in this. I know that Turkey is rather upset because the Uyghurs are a Turkic people. That's one way that identity plays in there, and I just see a lot of different threads in this. I know that there are some right wing groups in the U.S. that are very inclined to favor the Uyghur cause, and it seems mainly because it's a way of poking a stick into one of their favorite enemies, which is the Chinese. So if you could unpack that a little for me, I'd appreciate it. Is that enough to go on?
Yes, it is, and you're quite right about the migrant issue, of course. Many Han communities don't like migrants coming in. They view them as outsiders. And although everybody speaks Mandarin Chinese, they speak it quite differently in many different provinces, and that immediately marks you as someone from the outside. And that's been the case through much of the 20th century when there were early factories growing up and they needed to recruit workers. They would come in and they would find a lot of discrimination in Shanghai, for example, if they came from some other area and they didn't speak the correct kind of Chinese, so to speak. So that has been a longstanding issue, and the migrant problem is an enormous one. You're quite right. It's a huge population. It may be as much as 140 million or more. Some of these people are migrant for part of the time and then go back to their land and farm and then return to the city again to work. So there is a huge issue there. That part is very true. And it's something that the government, I think, saw as part of an economic driver or engine as it began to modernize. They needed workers for building up the cities, for infrastructure, for highways. And so they really had encouraged that. And although periodically they crack down and tell people to go home or revoke their rights to stay in the cities, nonetheless, they have used them, and they have taken advantage of that. And certainly there are many who say that's part of what's going on in Tibet and in Xinjiang. These people are coming in. They're there to make money. They really don't care anything about the local issues or population, and they may even not remain there. They may make their money and then leave. So economics are certainly an element of this, and it is Han presence in both Tibet and Xinjiang that has an impact. But your comment also about Turkey was interesting. I've been following some of that. Yes, the Turkish government has been very bold in its statements, saying that China really has to be careful of what it's doing with its Muslim population. There are, of course, people living in Turkey who originally are from Xinjiang. So there are communities all over. Many of the Kazakh people from China, some of the elite, I should say, from Xinjiang in the early 1950s made their way to Turkey, and they have lived in Turkey now ever since. So there are ties and connections between communities in Turkey and Xinjiang and other parts of the world. The great game politics, I'm not sure if we can really go back to the great game, although there are certainly elements as our presence, that is American presence in Afghanistan grows. Afghanistan has been a thorn in the side of many, an outside government that's tried to deal with it. And so this is definitely a harking back to the great game, which was played out in that same area of the world. China does have a border with Afghanistan as well, and it is one of the things that causes them a great deal of concern, and it's their rationale for bringing in even more troops. And I'm sure that process has not ended. They have indeed fortified all that border. One would hope that the Chinese government is going to back away in this instance from some of the worst kinds of punishments, that there is going to be an effort in this 60th anniversary year of the PRC to say that progress has been made in all these areas, not just economic, but in other areas as well. That is something that I would like to hope for. Whether that actually is going to be the outcome, that is quite another matter. Hmm.
Well, at that, I think that we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks very much to our guest, Linda Benson. She's a professor of history at Oakland University. That's in Rochester, Michigan. She's a specialist in modern China and Inner Asia. And Professor Benson, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.